serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to remember trailblazing heart surgeon and one of the nearly 1 million African Americans who served our country in uniform in World War II, Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, who passed away April 10th at the age of 98. He served with the 725th Medical Sanitation Company, a segregated unit that followed the 1st Marine Division throughout the Pacific.
Now, World War II was about the end of true world wars, true war. In World War II, the people you fought against was your enemy. Your job was to kill all of them or get killed. They were the enemy. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. Right. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. You just go out just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce, but you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
And what would you say were the times you look back on now as the close calls, as the closest you came to not coming home?
Well, one of the closest was when we hit Cebu City. We were on the ship, and we were not supposed to leave the ship because there were snipers in the city. But a group of us got together and said, Lord, you know, we've been all this time in the South Pacific and stuff, and of course, you know, the inhabitants were moved away, and we never ran across any women or anything like that, you know, and so on down the line, except, you know, nurses and stuff in the Army. So, man, you know, if we get into Cebu City, we might find some nice women we can work with. So what we did, we volunteered to help take some of the things off the ship, you know, down to the port. And, of course, what we had planned is once we got down on the port, we would take off to Cebu City. So we were there sitting down in this square in Cebu City. We were there, and we're drinking our booze and talking about, you know, where we're going to go to hunt up the women. And all of a sudden, the snipers opened on us. And this guy named Arthur was sitting next to me. Now, I'm here, and you, Arthur, there. And I'm looking him in the eye. And the snipers opened up, and a bullet hit him right in the middle of the forehead and killed him right there with me looking dead at him. Anyway, the rest of us, there were eight of us, we all ducked down and stuff, and we got away from there and returned. Now, we had to report the death. So we reported the death and of course, had to be honest and tell the captain, you know, how we managed to get there in the first place. He didn't put us in the brig, but what he did was this. He turned to me, because I was a corporal at the time, and he said, Corporal Marius, you are now responsible for alerting his parents of his death. And he put that ethos on me. And it was a tough one because he wouldn't have died if it hadn't been us talking into doing that. So that was one of the closest, you know, because I came across a lot of other things like, you know, bombs and stuff like that and rockets and things like that. But I was very, very fortunate. I didn't get not one injury the whole time. God was looking out for me.
And how hard was that to write that letter to his family?
Oh, man. It was really tough. I would have rather he stuck me in the brig than having to take that accountability. Yeah. Woo! Because, you know, when you're feeling guilty about your accountability in that and responsibility in that situation, and now you got to face a mother that you feel is, you happen to be partly responsible for the death of her son. Oh, man. That was heavy on my butt. Naturally, it taught me something. You know, let's face it, a lot of the things that you learn comes from the hard mistakes that you made. It's things like, for instance, Dr. Lowe, you know, in cardiac surgery, when you put into the aorta the major thing that you pump the blood back into the patient, you know, from the heart-lung machine. So it's a hole that you put a purse string around it and you tie it off and stuff like that. But then you have a small hole, which is kind of a needle hole, where you put a special good-sized needle where you clamp off the difference between that, and that's the one that you feed in the cold thing to stop the heart so that you can work on it. Now, Dr. Lowe, everybody else, when they take this one out, they tie it, and then they put extra stitches and maybe sometime even a patch across it because it's a decent hole. But the little string that comes out that little needle hole, you just tie that off. Dr. Lowe, on the other hand, he treats the other one, you know, routinely, but he puts extra stitches and a patch across the needle hole that comes out. If you didn't know, now I was there when the incident occurred at Children's Hospital, so I know why he did it. He did it because one day that needle hole thing broke and the blood started pumping out of there, and we had to save the patient's life before we could get the patient back in surgery. He and I had to open up the patient's chest, reach in and put our finger and sew that hole up right there to save that patient's life. So from that point on, so his experience with that problem is what caused his reaction afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with us. A lot of things that we do is based upon the experiences that we have gone through. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is no experience that does not affect, has an effect on your affect.
Well, I don't want to pry or put words in your mouth, but was the lesson of that experience with Arthur's death, was the lesson, don't put yourself in those kind of situations? Or what was it?
Well, the situation mostly was telling you, do what is right. Follow orders. You were told to keep your butt on the ship. You did not follow orders, and you're paying the consequence. You pay the price for the choice you make. And I'll say this about me. I have never been one who avoided saying that I'm paying the price. I have never been one who look around and make an excuse and say, well, if so-and-so made me do it. I go and look in the mirror first thing, and I say, Bert Maris, what did you do?
I'm curious about those guys that you served with. It's been so long now. How do you think they should be remembered? What was the significance of what you and those other guys did over there?
Well, it was an interesting unit because you only had three men there in the unit outside of the officer, you know, who was white, who had more than a second, third, or fifth grade education. They were from Biloxi, Mississippi, all of that unit, except us. Now, my good friend who was from Boston, myself, and this guy, Arthur guy, who was from Chicago, we were the only ones with college education. As a matter of fact, when I found out, I went to the regional commander and I asked him, was it all right if I started classes to teach them? Most of them couldn't even write or read. So they gave me qualifications to teach them basic fundamental subjects, and they would get credit for it back in America. So I started classes, and a number of those guys hated me because of that. They were saying because I had intel, I wanted to make them look stupid. But my attitude was not that. My attitude was to teach them, you know, to help them. But they didn't take that attitude, and one of them who claimed he was a preacher of God. We were chopping down trees and stuff in the swamps, and somebody said, look out. And I turned, and this axe was coming towards my head. He was trying to chop my head off. And I had my axe, and I blocked his. And anyway, at that time, I was really tough and strong. And as a matter of fact, after I beat the heck out of that sucker, and I had him underwater and was going to choke him to death, They saved his life by taking my butt off of him. But he wanted to kill me. But then later on, he come want to invite me to come to services with him. I say, well, I'm going to services. This sucker wanted to kill me. He called himself. But I taught a number of them how to read and write. But in those days, they weren't as strict. They needed fighting men, and they needed men to do certain jobs, and they didn't give a hoot whether you could read, write, or whatever. Just follow the orders. So, yes, those men needed a lot of help, and, you know, I had a lot of things that I still, you know, based upon the kind of background and traditions that I grew up in among my family, that you be productive. You know, I tried even then to be productive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I painted a lot of watercolor paintings while I was over there, and I mailed them out and stuff. Mm-hmm. I have no idea where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even remember who I mailed them to or anything like that. So I don't know how many paintings I got around anywhere. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt died and Harry Truman took over, I became immediately depressed because here, this president was born in Missouri, a southern area. So there was no way in the world. Now, if I thought, you know, prejudicial things were running bad under Franklin D. Roosevelt, it was certainly going to be worse under Harry Truman. But to my amazement, Harry Truman removed discrimination from the armed force.
He integrated all of them.
That's right. He removed it completely, did exactly the opposite of what I expected. So that's one of the greatest things that Harry Truman did during his administration.
Well, and he did it. I wasn't alive. I didn't see it. But don't you think one of the reasons he did it is because of what you guys did in the war and what you proved you were capable of, the allegiance and loyalty that you proved, even though you weren't getting everything you deserved here?
Well, I think Harry Truman did it because he had a heart change, personal heart change, and that's why he pushed it and did it. So he saw it was wrong, and he saw that all citizens should be treated exactly the same if they're going to sacrifice their lives for the country. So yes, he made a start for it. But remember, all of this went on, but it was not until you started to get to the times of Martin Luther King and all of those kind of, like I'm demonstrating that big painting in there, that you began to actively begin to change the civil rights situation, you know, little by little. When I got discharged in 1946 and went back to New York City, I went back to finish my last 2 years of college and pre-med, and I graduated in 1948. I applied to École des Beaux-Arts, Université de Paris. École des Beaux-Arts, a school of wonderful arts, and it was the finest art school in the world at the time, and I got accepted. So I was on my way down with a letter saying, yes, I'm coming. And I had the letter. And I remember I was living on 148th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And usually I walk down there and 146th Street on that same side of the street is the post office and drop the mail and then go to 145th Street and take the subway down to work. But as I got to the vestibule, I remember I hadn't picked up the mail for yesterday. So I went to the mailbox and opened up the mailbox, and inside the mailbox was a letter from Howard University. So I opened up the letter, and the letter said, you have been accepted to medical school at Howard University. Send a $50 retainer. At this time, you know, blacks at this time would jump 3 feet up in the air and say, Lord, I'm in medical school. Yeah. Instead, I took my cap and I banged it on the ground and started cussing. I said, God dog, now I got to make a cotton-picking decision. And I said, I'm not going to stress myself over this. And I got a silver half a dollar out of my pocket, and I flipped it. And I said, if it lands head, I'm going to medical school. If it lands tail, I'm going to Paris. And it landed heads. So I went all the way back upstairs, tore up the letter to Paris, wrote a check for $50, put it in the letter and a stamp on it, and mailed it. And I went to medical school on the flip of a coin. That was God working on my butt, not me. Because later I got to be thinking, I said, now, at this time, I hadn't given my heart and soul to Jesus Christ. I'm the only one standing in that vestibule. I said that to myself. Now, why didn't I, since I wanted to go to Paris, when it landed down, heads, I said, oh, it landed just like I wanted, heads for Paris. I could easily said that. Why did I keep my oath? It was the Lord working on my butt in spite of me. Because if that hadn't happened, no way in the world would I wound up here in Fresno. No way in the world would I be part of working with Byron Evans in 1958 to start the first open heart surgery here in Fresno. No way in the world would I have, after my wife had divorced me in 1966, would I have met my other wife, Dorothy, and become a Christian. She was part of the influence of me becoming a true Christian and giving myself truly to the Lord and Savior. None of that would have happened. I wouldn't have had my youngest son. None of that. Y'all would be paying big money for dressing up the clothing design by Fitzalbert Michel Marius.
All the celebrities would be wearing it, right?
That's right. All the celebrities would be wearing it because I would have been the first black designer in the world.
55 years of doing these kind of heart surgeries and all those patients that you dealt with, the lives that they led after that, the gift of life you're able to give to so many. What are you most proud of when you think back on that medical career? What gives you the most pride or satisfaction?
Well, the most thing that gives me the pride and satisfaction is that I have come to the point that I understand that anything and everything that Bert Marius is able to accomplish, it is because God gave me the ability to do it. All that matters is whether I am doing it according to his will, not according to my own desire. I can't remember the very last time that I had any anxiety about anything. Just like you see me and most people, and they always ask me, says, how come you always got a smile on your face? I said, because I got joy to come from within. I'm not stressed out about nothing. I go to bed every night absolutely peaceful. Without him, none of this is possible. You know, being a poet and stuff, I pray this way. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me I'm birthed from dirt and would be completely inert if it were not for you. I thank the Lord for using me to further his kingdom in spite of my human deficiencies and inefficiency. That I'm not taking any credit for any of this myself. The only credit I've taken is the fact that I'm willing to submit to his will and be his steward and his messenger.
What a privilege it was to watch as he shared that message wherever he went, as productive and impactful in his final 7 years after retiring at 91 as he was in 55 years as a heart surgeon. So dedicated, so talented, so spirited, so memorable. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, truly one of a kind. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.